This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In recent years, there have been a number of incidents where teenagers and young adults have walked into schools, movie theaters, and other public places and used guns on innocent victims, many of them other children. In each case, it was determined that these young people suffered from mental illnesses, and we are told that if we placed more emphasis on mental health care, these incidences would be reduced. Surely there is some truth to that. But the mentally disturbed young people who have perpetrated these crimes aren't the only children who suffer from mental health issues. The Children's Defense Fund reports that of the 2,278,000 children living in our state, one in five of them, almost 500,000 kids, suffer from an emotional or behavioral problem, and 10% of those children, nearly 228,000, need professional treatment. Many of these young people suffer as the result of extremely traumatic events in their lives, physical and sexual abuse, neglect, and maltreatment. It is challenging to treat those who have suffered from these traumas, and many times even more challenging for them to get access to treatment. So today we spend time with four people who understand this problem all too well. They are going to help us shed some light on how we deal with mental health issues and how treatment is provided. Dr. Dawn O'Malley is a licensed clinical psychologist and clinical director of the Alexander Youth Network, which provides professional treatment to children with serious emotional and behavioral problems. Welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Kelly Shearer is Chief Program Officer for Clinical Programs at the Alexander Youth Network. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Dr. Susan Campbell, Ph.D., is Executive Director of the Council for Children's Rights, Charlotte Mecklenburg's leading advocate for children. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Robert McCarter is Managing Attorney for the Council for Children's Rights. Mr. McCarter was also a co-founder of the Children's Law Center, which represents children in all areas involving judicial and mental health proceedings. Good to see you as well.
Good morning.
Good morning. Most people probably don't think, really, on a general basis, of children being affected by mental illness until one of these incidents crops up in the news. How common is it, and what forms of mental illness seem to be most common among young people? I'm not sure who to ask that question of, so maybe I'll begin with Dr. O'Malley.
Well, how common is it? I think that we are at a time, actually a pretty exciting and transformative time, understanding the way the brain works and how children are impacted by the experiences that they have. Since during childhood, our brain is developing most rapidly, and it's when it's most vulnerable to both bad experience and most open to the good experiences that we need in order to form a healthy emotional and, you know, mental health life.
I mean, the worst experiences that we know about, the general public knows about, with regard to mental illness among young people are these incidences like Sandy Hook Elementary and Columbine High School and places like that. But this evidently is far broader than that and more deeply entrenched into our youth culture. The numbers that I just gave would indicate that, and that's just right in North Carolina. Is this something new, or has this always been the case?
I would posit that it's probably always been the case, but I think there are certainly increased stressors right now for families with the economic situation that a lot of families are experiencing. So there's a higher risk for domestic violence, for separation and divorce, for lots of things that can impact a child's day-to-day life in negative ways.
And what role do the preponderance of single-family households, the absence of fathers or drug-addicted mothers or video games or violence in the culture, what role does all that play, if any? Or do we know?
I think that we know that it's having an impact, and we're not exactly sure what that is. So we know a whole lot about what a young child needs in order to have optimal brain development. We know that they need to have patterned, repetitive experiences, which are things like just going to bed at the same time every day, eating meals at the same time, knowing when you do what in your household. We know that they need those kinds of experiences. We know, for example, that kids need to pick up blocks and toys and turn them around in order for that part of their brain to develop optimally. So we don't know, for example, the difference between reading a book that has pages that turn and reading a book on an e-reader. We know it's going to have an impact. We just don't have enough information yet. It hasn't been, those things haven't been around long enough to know what way it's going to impact children.
And Robert McCarter, you're an attorney and you've worked both with children on a judicial basis and on a mental health basis. In the time that you've been doing that, and I'm not sure how long you've been doing it, but probably for a while.
40 years.
Okay.
So.
Have you seen an uptick in children who need these services?
I think what Dr. Campbell alluded to earlier is when we see upticks. When there's an economic condition that creates additional stress on families, then the families sometimes break up, sometimes just have disagreements in the home. And in those situations, the children are impacted. Mm-hmm. When we represent children and talk to them, they will tell us, look, my mom's doing this, my dad's doing this. They didn't used to do that. And so those are the kind of the societal pressures, the economy, that now we have sexting and texting and selfies and everything else. And kids want to explore those things. Mm-hmm. And it's a new way to express their rebellion in those years.
Well, I've forgotten which program NPR carries that talked about brain development and the discoveries that we're uncovering with brain development. But it was on Monday, and one of the things that they talked about was the natural progression of young people through the teenage years breaking away from their parents and wanting to spend more time in the world, exploring the world, more time being with their peers because it was new and adventurous. And it's normal, although it's sometimes frustrating to parents. That's a normal part of life. But in this world where we have selfies and sexting and texting and the internet, it's more dangerous. Is it also more Is there also greater potential for children to get into mental troubles because they don't have the capacity to understand what they're experiencing?
Yes, definitely. What we know is that the brain is in charge of everything we do, think, feel, want, need, and that its primary objective is to keep us alive. So actually, National Geographic did an entire issue on the adolescent brain. And what they talked about is that history has documented that adolescents go through this period that you're talking about where they sort of leaving the home, experimenting with things, trying out new things. And what this article talked about is that the brain, we would have stopped doing that if it were not helpful to our development and to our survival. And so what they said is during this time period, it would be very important for people to put aside fears in a lot of ways, right? So if you're in a tribal society and you at 12 and 13 need to learn how to go hunt, you have to be able to feel immortal, to be able to feel like excitement about it and sort of suspend some of the fears. Our society has changed so rapidly, I'm not sure that the safeties have caught up with that. So in this scenario of a tribal society, you've got a whole band of men around you protecting you and making sure things go okay. We don't have that so much. So, yes, I do think that our society has developed far more rapidly than our brain can catch up to and make sure that we make safe decisions.
Plus, it seems to me in these tribal societies, there are ritual rites of that are supervised
by
adults
who've
been through it themselves and who know the consequences. We have two organizations with us around this table today, the Alexander Youth Network and the Council for Children's Rights. Although they are complementary organizations, they do different, completely different things for the most part. But in both of your organizations, when you're working with children who have these mental challenges, how many children are we talking about? How many children do you have programs for? How many programs do you have for these kids, for instance, at the Alexander Youth Network? Kelly Shearer?
Yes. Alexander provides services for children ages 3 through 21, and we are always amazed at how young children may need some treatment. But Alexander has been a provider of mental health services since the 60s. However, it has existed since 1888, and we just celebrated our 125th anniversary.
Okay.
So we offer 6 levels of care. And so one of the benefits of that is as a child's needs change, their treatment needs change, they don't need to change providers. One provider can continue to meet their needs. And it goes from a high-end level of residential treatment, subacute, medical model residential treatment, on down through what you would most know as traditional outpatient treatment.
How many kids do you serve every year?
Last year, Alexander helped over 7,000 children, and on any given day, over 430 children.
And it's in the Charlotte region.
Well, right? That is our headquarters, and we serve children across the Piedmont area and western North Carolina.
So put that number into perspective. Is that a big number? Is it a small number? Is it
I wish it were bigger.
Average number across America?
Well, for a provider, it's a fairly large size. We're a fairly large size provider. However, for the need that's out there, it's unfortunately not large enough. As you quoted earlier, you know, there are over 200,000 children in need of mental health treatment. Mm-hmm. And so 7,000 is not very much of that.
How many of the kids that the Council for Children's Rights deals with on an annual basis are children who need the services of an organization like Alexander Youth Network or other mental health help? Or do you know?
I think Robert and I can respond to that in two ways. Council for Children's Rights has a couple of unique approaches to this. We have a direct legal services program that provides legal representation to children who have mental health, custody, educational, emotional, behavioral needs. I'll let Robert tell a little bit more about the legal services part of the program. That program serves about 2,500 children per year. We also function as a children's intermediary working on behalf of all the children of Charlotte-Mecklenburg through research on best practices and disseminating those practices to programs so that they really are basing their services on what the literature says works best. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy is one of the models of psychotherapy that has the most research behind it in terms of effectiveness in dealing with trauma.
That's actually where I wanted to go to next, but I wanted to ask you before we do that, when a child is going through some of these legal difficulties that may stem from parents separating or from trouble they've gotten into because of their acting out as a result of not fully understanding what's going on with their parents or in their families or with the lack of supervision that they have because they come from dysfunctional families, does it necessarily follow then that they are suffering from some sort of mental disorder, if not mental illness, some sort of cognitive problem because they're not living in what we would think of as a normal situation?
I don't think it necessarily follows, but okay. It does often follow. The part of the challenges that we all face is that parents, the definition for a child being voluntarily admitted to a residential facility, a locked facility, mm-hmm. It's not voluntary on the child's part. It's voluntary on the parent's part. They're the ones who sign them in and out. So the law says if the child has a mental health issue or a substance abuse problem, the parent can do that. The parent also is in the controlling authority for what kind of treatment they approve or disapprove of within the facility, although the child may have input into that. But when you circle back around to it, then you've got the court reviewing that to see if they in fact meet the standard. And the standard then becomes, is there a less restrictive way to treat the child? And so we move to a place where there is a dearth of services.
We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about this mental health problem with children, particularly with regard to traumatic events and how you treat those traumas when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and British American School of Charlotte, empowering individual achievement for students age 2 through high school, hosting an admissions open house Wednesday, January 22nd from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. Details at britishschoolofcharlotte.org. Well, it's the time of year that we all resolve to save money, to spend less, to waste less, perhaps lose weight. Well, we can't help you with that last one, but we're going to take a look at some of the first three of those other things. We'll get some tips tomorrow from experts who make it their business to know how to save money, to waste less, to spend less. Practical, realistic ways, they tell us, to keep your New Year's resolutions. And we'll do that tomorrow morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Congress faces a full agenda in 2014. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi on extending unemployment benefits to prospects for immigration reform. What to expect from Congress in this election year?
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about mental health issues with young people today. Dr. Dawn O'Malley's with us. She's the clinical director. And Kelly Shearer is the chief program officer of the Alexander Youth Network. They take care of a lot of these issues for a lot of children every year. Dr. Susan Campbell is executive director of the Council for Children's Rights, and Robert McCarter is the managing attorney there. They look out for children and the rights of children. It's in the title of the organization. In the opening, I said that many children suffer mental illness after traumatic events, physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, maltreatment. Are these the tougher cases?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Alexander Youth Network probably, you know, sees its fair share or unfair share of those group of kids. When Mr. McCarter referred to our residential programs, those are our highest end level 6 programs where children are living on campus and essentially in a treatment environment 24 hours a day. The vast majority of those kids have had early childhood experiences that are just horrific.
And these physical traumas, the physical abuse, et cetera, lead to what you term as mental traumas. How would you define a mental trauma?
Well, with the kids that we serve, the majority of those kids have had those horrific experiences very early in life, some of them even before birth. So they've got a mother who's in a domestic violence situation, and she's under acute stress, and those stress hormones are actually, you know, affecting their growth in the womb. And that continues after birth, right? So when we're born, our brain parts are all there, but they don't really know what they're supposed to do. And they figure out what they're supposed to do based on the experiences that we have. So again, if you take an infant or, you know, young toddler who is living with domestic violence in the home, there, when an outburst occurs and there's lots of yelling and chaos and it's a fearful situation, a potentially traumatic situation, the stress hormone gets dumped into the brain and in between those, you know, where the synapses are between our transmitters. And the brain says, oh, hey, I'm supposed to form, all kinds of stress hormones here. We have all kinds of excitement in this household. Let me, instead of forming the 100,000 stress receptors, I'm going to form, you know, 10 million stress receptors. Now we have a child, whose brain is primed for, scanning the environment, for just constantly on edge because their brain has been essentially geared and developed and formed again, to keep them alive, and it's a, you know, an adaptive strategy at that time.
And this is why you say that this kind of mental trauma produces powerful, painful thoughts, and it can also produce extreme behavior.
That's right. That's right. Because essentially what you have is a child whose fear response, you know, fight or flight response is on go constantly. For those of us who have not had that early childhood experience, our fight or flight system works really as it should, like a smoke alarm. It goes off when there's a danger. It tells us that system is, again, put in place for our survival. We wouldn't have it if it weren't useful. It goes off when it should. It goes off when there's a loud noise behind us, a really loud noise. You know, we turn around to see what happens. We make a decision about fight or flight.
And do most of these symptoms begin early in life, or
absolutely,
could they begin later? If the parents have a troubled domestic relationship later in life,
right,
when the child's a teenager or 11 years old,
right,
could the same things begin to happen at that age?
Yes, they can. But I think it's a great point, which is that our brain is developing most rapidly from age, you know, from birth to age five. Okay, so if we're living through a lot of negative traumatic experience, it's going to essentially influence strongly the way our brain is formed. That's much, much more difficult to treat. Okay, mm-hmm. because our brain has formed around those experiences. If we've had a fairly normative development and then something bad happens when we're 11 or 12, it's more like leaving a wound on the brain as opposed mm-hmm. to completely organizing around
it. I ask because some of the symptoms of this include, according to material you gave us, withdrawal or detachment, lack of concentration, irritability, and aggression. And some of these sound like the signs of being a teenager. Does that make this more difficult to diagnose or treat? And how do you know, as a parent or an adult in that child's life, when to be worried and when to simply chalk this behavior up to being a teenager?
Right. The best way, parents ask those kinds of questions all the time, to ask yourself, using a yardstick type of metaphor. There are certain tasks that need to be accomplished during each phase of life, and there are a lot more of them, and they what we need to accomplish changes more rapidly during childhood. But if your child is essentially developing and doing the things that are important during that time of life, that tells us that the mental health issues or whatever the struggles are not getting in the way of a normal developmental trajectory. When the issues take kids off that path and they're not doing the things they need to be doing, having the experiences they need to be having. For example, as a teenager, if you're struggling with depression and you are in your room all the time, you're not doing the things that we talked about earlier. You're not going out with friends. You're not problem solving out in the community. You're not having those experiences that are very important for development at that time. Then we've got something we need to focus on.
And Kelly, Sherry, you mentioned all the programs that you have at the Alexander Youth Network for kids of various ages, beginning at three all the way up through young adulthood. For those who have a mental issue that is the result of certain traumas in their lives, you have begun to develop, I understand, what you describe as innovative strategies to impact more hard-to-reach regions of a child's brain. Is this what you mean by trauma-informed therapy?
Yes, I think that would fall under that terminology. We use a model that was developed by Dr. Bruce Perry of the Child Trauma Academy in Houston, Texas, and we are one of only four flagship organizations of the Child Trauma Academy in the world, and we're quite proud of that, and we were the first. And Dr. O'Malley is a fellow.
How did that happen?
Well, we became partners with Dr. Bruce Perry and the Child Trauma Academy. They had developed research and principles, theories, and we became the testing ground, essentially, for a lot of those philosophies that they've developed. And so they needed a place at which they could practice the techniques that they've developed, and we became that, I guess, opportunity for them.
How long has this been going on?
Alexander has been working together with the Child Trauma Academy for over 5 years.
So you have some track record now?
Yes, we do. We are well established in the model.
And the track record would indicate what?
Well, we have seen some amazing successes. I think most recently we received some publicity in People magazine about one of the children who we served using this model who has had very positive, outstanding results. The story was called Saving Jed.
I read that story.
Yes.
It's very interesting. It's about a young boy who was, traumatized as an infant, really.
Horribly so.
Horrible. Chained up to a bed and starved, essentially, by his mentally ill parents.
Yes.
And went through a series of foster homes, never felt loved, ran away whenever he felt the slightest provocation of being threatened.
Fight or flight response.
And mm-hmm. finally met a counselor who as a child had done the same thing. So he recognized the behavior in Jed, stopped him, adopted him, and now Jed is becoming a full-fledged, normal adult?
Yes. He's just right on the trajectory that we would like to see for someone of his age.
And how old is he now?
He's a young man. He's 20, I believe.
And he's here in Charlotte?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And how would you rank him on the scale of from where he came into this situation to where he is today?
Well, there isn't a comparison that I could make that most people would understand.
So this would indicate that behaviors that are so destructive, to not only families, but to the young person that would normally put that kid in prison at some point in their life.
Yes.
These patterns can be reversed.
Yes, the resiliency is amazing. We are just so impressed and excited about the opportunities that we're providing these children through these patterned, repetitive, activity-based interventions.
The Council for Children's Rights says it's important to adopt trauma-informed risk screening and triage procedures to benefit children, and that there must be an understanding of a commitment to routine trauma screening across all child-serving systems. I'm not sure what that means, but tell me what it means and what it would look like.
Well, perhaps Dr. O'Malley might be better able to explain that,
or the Council for Children's Rights, since they said it.
Well, and I think we can tag on that, because I think what we are, as I was saying earlier, part of what the council does is research evidence-based practice, like what they are each talking about in terms of what we know works from a treatment standpoint with children, and. So we propose the research, we accumulate the research, disseminate that, and then we really advocate policy that is informed by that. So policy changes within workplaces, within agencies that recognize that being trauma-informed, understanding that, you know, 250,000 of the children that you may encounter in North Carolina have some kind of issue that needs attention and may need to be worked with in a different kind of way requires that you screen it up front. One of the things I talked to some folks last night about my work prior to coming here and sitting in IEP meetings with a child who the school
IEP meeting
individual education plan. Okay. Meetings within the school system, the school's required to educate a child in the way that they need. Mm-hmm. And so if your child has special needs, you are oftentimes a special education plan will be developed for you. In this particular case, this school was very convinced that this child was ADHD. They wanted the mom to get him put on medicine. I was treating that child. That child had post-traumatic stress disorder. He did not have ADHD. There are a lot of crossover symptoms in terms of distractibility and anxiety and poor control of emotions that look like what somebody who doesn't know about trauma thinks is ADHD. So what we are encouraging is the adoption of screening practices that really help agencies become aware more clearly up front what kinds of trauma the children may be facing that need a different approach.
What does Dr. Campbell mean by screening practices? I'm sure you engage in these, Dr. O'Malley, so tell me what she means.
Right. I think Dr. Campbell is hitting on it directly, which is that mental health, I think because of the complexity of the brain, it's the one part of the body that we can't transplant. We've been able to open up a heart and figure out that it works like a pump, and we just don't have that level of understanding of the brain. So historically, we've essentially treated the behaviors that we saw. So bouncing up and down in your seat at school, we'll give you a pill that's going to reduce that, or we'll let you have a squishy seat that you can bounce up and down on so you don't bother everybody. But there wasn't a lot of attention to what in fact may be causing that, because we just didn't really understand it. And that is what makes children's mental health so difficult to understand, because the behavioral things you see have so much crossover. A truly ADHD child does look like an anxious child, could look like a depressed child. The symptoms look very similar, even though the causes may be extremely different. So as far as screening goes, what we want to make sure that we do is a very, very thorough developmental history. So asking what happened to a child, what was their life like, what was the level of stress in the family through each significant period of development. And one of the things that Dr. Perry advocates is that is that a trauma-informed clinician always do their own assessment. Just because somebody did a terrific one 2 years ago and they came up with a diagnosis of ADHD, you need to ask your own set of questions.
Does every child who's exhibiting symptoms of some sort of mental health issue, does it always stem from a trauma? At what point do you have to know that this child needs trauma-informed help versus just mental health help in general? How do you know? And who would make
through
that
assessment? So no.
Would any child psychologist or psychiatrist or mental health professional, a social worker, know to do this, to put these children through screening like this? Or is this something that really requires somebody who has an intimate understanding of it, as you obviously do?
I think that that there aren't as many people in our community that understand the way – our learning of how trauma impacts all growth and development throughout the lifespan for folks who've had those early traumatic experiences. The number of people who understand that are fairly limited, mm-hmm. particularly when you get to a 14 or 15-year-old really mean, really nasty adolescent. It could be very difficult to have empathy and to think back about what the early experience.
And that's where the legal system starts coming in, because obviously if you're 8 years old and you're throwing blocks across the room and maybe breaking your television, your big screen television in the living room, that's not going to get to the police department. But if you start shoplifting and acting out and hurting other people and stealing from other people, you end up in the court system. Has the court system reached the stage, the judicial system reached the stage, where they understand that some of these children suffer from these mental health problems that are at the root cause from traumas that they suffered through no fault of their own? And are they willing to make sentencing appropriate for those situations?
I need to talk about two parts of the court system and maybe more, but certainly there are a number of judges who have that understanding, in particular the judges who operate in juvenile court have that understanding and effectively design and implement dispositional plans for children who are in juvenile court, either through delinquency or abuse or neglect or whatever the reason that brought them in there, to try to address those problems. But the reason, or another part of the reason that the screening is so important, is because if we don't identify it and we don't deal with it as these children are children, they take it with them to adulthood. And then you're overburdening, again, the adult court system, divorce, criminal law, the entire system's impacted by it. And so it's almost a pay me now or pay me later. And I'm not sure that the adult system is quite as informed of that, or at least doesn't have maybe the flexibility to deal with it that the juvenile system does.
There are several. There's so many issues to talk about with this. I don't even know where to begin. But there is a societal cost to all of this, as you just pointed out. And yet, on the other hand, there's this stigma that is still attached with going after and getting mental health help, whether it's your child. You don't want to admit that your child needs that, or yourself as an adult maybe need it because you never got it as a child. But our prisons are full of people probably that needed this help and could have benefited from this help and would not be there had they gotten the help. Which is more expensive, to put them in prison or to get them this help?
By far, it's more expensive to put them in prison and to keep them there and to keep arresting them and putting them back there and to keep dealing with the other problems that they've caused within society while they're out of prison. That's a huge, huge cost. I don't know. I can't put a number on it, but it's far more expensive than simply dealing with it effectively up front.
And tragic, if I can jump in too,
right.
Because I think one of the issues too is access to appropriate kinds of treatment that result from trauma-informed people really researching that. We see a huge dearth of services for juvenile sex offenders.
Mm-hmm.
Many juvenile sex offenders have been victims themselves of sexual abuse. They're having abuse-reactive behaviors. And we're not treating them, and they're ending up doing that when they're 16, and then they're in jail for the rest of their
lives. It's like the cycle of violence in domestic abuse. You have to break the cycle.
Right.
Because that's all they know. And as you point out, children who suffer from untreated mental trauma are more likely to have cardiovascular disease, asthma, high blood pressure, and are 10 times more likely to commit a crime and have poor grades. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Atrium Animal Hospital and Wellness Center, providing holistic animal health care for 17 years, offering pet parents a strategy to achieve and maintain furry family vitality. AtriumAnimalHospital.com. Well, Congress begins 2014 with a full agenda, including a vote on extending unemployment benefits, negotiating the debt ceiling, and prospects for immigration reform. Diane Rehm and her guests talk about what to expect from Congress this election year, coming up in 20 minutes, about 10 o'clock here on the Diane Rehm Show on WFAE. If you'd like to join our conversation, a great place to start is WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. That'll get you through to us, and we are coming right back.
News happens all week, all around the world.
If you want to understand what this French election is all about...
Four candidates are running unopposed, and three of them met reporters Thursday.
Whatever the outcome of today's elections, the secessionist genie is out of the bottle.
News, analysis, perspective, music, books, and sports, too. Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Tune in for Weekend Edition Saturday and Sunday mornings from 8 until 10 here on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Dr. Dawn O'Malley and Kelly Shearer. They are the Clinical Director and Chief Program Officer of the Alexander Youth Network. Dr. Susan Campbell is Executive Director, and Robert McCarter is Managing Attorney for the Council for Children's Rights. And we're talking about mental health programs for children, and something called, I had not known about this until we started doing research on this program, and that is the trauma, I'm going to get this wrong now, what's the official name of this kind of therapy? Trauma-based therapy.
Trauma-informed therapy.
Trauma-informed
therapy.
Before we talk about this trauma-informed therapy and how it works, what has been the normal treatment for young people who exhibit these behaviors that would indicate that they need some sort of mental health? How have they been treated in the past?
Right. Really from a very behavioral approach. So even at the residential program at Alexander Youth Network, we started when I came 6 years ago, very traditional program with a point system, right? A consequence levels system. So you do X, Y, and Z thing today or all week. You finish your homework, you talk respectfully to the staff people, then you earn a reward on Friday. You get to have fun Friday. What we realized and why really we got connected with the Child Trauma Academy is that doesn't work at all with kids who have had trauma, because that kind of system assumes that you have the cognitive capacity to say, well, hey, if I can sit in my seat and behave myself today and Thursday and Friday, I get to go to Fun Friday afternoon. So let me choose to sit still in my seat and I will say please and thank you to my staff. Well, we all know that we take a child who's had the kind of experience, the traumatic experiences, into our office and we say, you know, hey, you hit Johnny in class yesterday, so let's find three ways or three different things you could do tomorrow so you don't hit him. You could tell the teacher he's bugging you. You could try to ignore him. You could make it a nice assertive statement back. And we all know that kiddo goes back to school the next day and he's going to sock Johnny again when he says something about his mama. Okay, because those behaviors are coming from a very different part of the brain, not from the front of our brain where our cortex and our thinking and problem solving live. They're coming from the part of the brain where our fight or flight system is, and you cannot talk to those parts of the brain. Okay, our brain is specifically wired to actually shut down the cognitive parts of our brain when we're under stress or threat. So if you could imagine being held up at an ATM machine, somebody's got a gun at your back, you're not thinking about what you're going to make for dinner, okay, or the errands you've got to get done. Your brain's going to shut down that piece. The same is true for kids in a situation where they feel threatened. And again, we've said they tend to feel threatened at 100 times more situations than your average person would. So you have to do things that heal those parts of the brain, and that again is not talk therapy.
Yeah, you use what you call a neurosequential model of therapeutics, and I take it this is what you use to that gives you the ability to assess which parts of the brain the child has been most impacted by.
That's
mistreatment
right.
of the child. How do you do that? If you can't see the brain, you can't take pieces of it out and look at it and
yeah.
say, well, that's broken, let's fix that. How do you do it?
That's right. What we do know are that there are behaviors and observable things that will tell us how each region of the brain is functioning. So, for example, the very lowest part of our brain, the brain stem that keeps us alive, it mm-hmm. regulates our heartbeat, we can tell how that's functioning by taking a measure of, simple as that, your heart rate. Okay, and you mentioned earlier the types of diseases that children or people who've had traumatic experiences seem to exhibit. That's a really good example. If you have an early childhood experience of trauma, your heart rate is going to be much higher than the average person. We can measure that. We can see that a child's heart rate tends to be far outside the norm, either much lower than we would expect or much higher. And then having had that experience for a lifetime causes things like heart disease and hypertension and all kinds mm-hmm. of other problems. Mm-hmm. So there are measurable things that we can take a look
but
at.
But if you can't talk to the brain, if you can't tell your brain, okay, look, just relax,
right.
how do you help them?
Well, we know what each part of the brain needs to grow and develop. So for that lower part, the brain stem, it needs patterned, repetitive activities. Think about the things that...
It's like Pavlov's dogs? Seriously.
A little. I guess I was going to say, you think about what we do to soothe a crying infant.
Okay.
We rock them. Okay. We bounce them up and down just a little bit. Those kinds of things, actually, if you measure them, we tend to do at the same rate as a heart rate. Okay. There are natural rhythms and things like that.
You mentioned Jed Kelly, the story that about this local boy who appeared in People magazine. He exhibited a lot of these behaviors,
right.
and obviously he had severe trauma as a child. What techniques did his foster parents, the ones that have had success, what did they use, and what kind of other outside help did they get to help that child become the person that he is today?
Mm-hmm. Well, it took a lot of people working together in concert because we had to provide, first of all, an environment in which Jed felt safe
mm-hmm.
because that helps what we call cool down the brainstem.
And what was different about this environment of the people who had success with him ultimately versus the people who had him before in the foster care system?
Right. They were less reactive to those surface behaviors. They did not allow – they were committed to Jed, and they did not allow those behaviors that were so disruptive and really difficult for most anyone to deal with. They did not allow those to alienate their mission to commit to Jed.
I don't understand how – help me understand how that manifests itself, because a lot of people, particularly if it's your child, are committed to their child. They just can't put up with the behavior, and they don't know what to do about the behavior, and the behavior seems absolutely insurmountable. So what does that mean to be committed and not letting the behaviors get in the way? What does that mean?
I think, yeah, it takes a special type of foster parent and
a parent that
recognizes why the child's doing what they're doing, that it's trauma-based, and that it's not about them. It's not a reflection on them every time. And Jed continued to run away. That was his behavior. He used to run away from our residential program.
Mm-hmm.
He continued to run away when he moved in with his foster parents, who eventually adopted him. That they didn't call the police every time that happened. They went out and they looked for him and they found him. They didn't, if they needed to take him to the hospital because he was really in crisis, they were there for him when he came back out. I think lots of times parents just, paid caretakers, they don't want to deal with it. I'm not going to. This reflects badly on me. It makes me look like I'm not doing a good job. So I'm not willing to do it anymore. And that's not the approach that this family took with him. And I do think that for him, that was the primary thing that helped him to heal.
Dr. Campbell,
I think a lot of that too has to do with willingness to keep your own emotions down,
right.
like she's saying, and not react to it as a reflection on you, and then willingness to get the tools that allow you to know what to do.
That takes real fortitude, doesn't it? Particularly if you're the relative.
It certainly takes the fortitude to manage your own emotional reactivity. I think any of us who are parents know that. But I think also that piece that says, this is beyond my capacity. This is beyond something that I understand how to deal with. So I am going to seek out the assistance and the tools so that I know, okay, I need to take a time out and breathe and apply a strategy that I know works. And that's one of the things that I think we are really encouraging folks is to get the tools. You know, if your children are having issues, you know, don't feel like it's a failure on your part to reach out for help, because everybody needs some help, and particularly people who are dealing with children with significant issues.
You know, in the aftermath of Sandy Hook, we heard people say, well, you know, children are resilient. And the young people who were in that school who survived, obviously that was a highly traumatic experience in their lives. And I'm wondering how traumatic it was for school children of that age elsewhere in the country who simply watched it all on television because they couldn't be protected from it for very long. Are we going to see in 5 years or 3 years or 10 years a lot of kids exhibiting behaviors that might be the result of that traumatic event?
Yes. Actually, what we do know is that in any given traumatic event, if you take the Sandy Hook, the survivors of Sandy Hook, about 30% of those kids could potentially develop PTSD, another post-traumatic stress disorder. The remainder will not, and there are lots of reasons why that is. One factor, and then for those of the rest of us who are exposed to it, the further away you get from the situation, both, you know, geographically or how much time you spent watching it, the less likely you are to develop any trauma-related symptoms. But you potentially still can.
So this old phrase that we hear all the time, that children are resilient, they bounce back, it rolls off their back, it's not necessarily true.
It's not necessarily true for every child. What really that's relating to is essentially in that potentially traumatic situation, it is how your body responds to the stressor. So if your system becomes overloaded with stress and, you know, really struggles, you're going to be much more likely to have trauma-related symptoms later.
And is that why in a family that is dysfunctional, where you may have one child who is severely traumatized by living in that group of people, another sibling may not exhibit the same behaviors or have the same problems because they're simply built differently? Is that essentially true?
Yes, it can be true. Yes. I think there's lots of factors that relate that play into that. But
yeah. Well, and I'll add a quick piece that there are, you know, that's the nature part of it. That's how mm-hmm. you're wired and your temperament and how your particular – what your genetic predispositions are to vulnerability. But there also are external things that really build resilience. So the resiliency literature talks about, you know, you can have something traumatic like Jed. But if there is someone who – is willing to stay with you and correct those experiences, to provide a corrective relationship that communicates to you, you are worthy, you are capable of getting through this, I care about you, and who will be consistently responding in a loving way, that is a protective factor. Being really good at something like the violin or soccer
right.
is a buffer against.
Those go back to why it's so important to do a thorough developmental history and assessment, because the amount of resilience a child will have will also depend on when things happened, what happened, when was there another loving person available. You know, that relates back to how we treat kids and how much money we spend when. It's much right. easier to give kids what they need 0 to 5 and prevent sort of serious kinds of problems that kids have later in life. But we tend to, you know, treat it when it becomes a crisis, right. not provide prevention.
Robert McCarver.
And I think that children are in general resilient, but each one is kind of like a rubber band, Mike. You at some point that resilience wears out. You can only stretch it so many times and have it go back, and then it's gone. And that's what happens with children as well. And at that point, they are broken, mm-hmm. and it's very, very difficult to reinstall.
Something that Dr. O'Malley just said, the costs involved in waiting until a child reaches a crisis moment, and that could be later in life, it could be a serious crime that they've committed, etc.
Right.
The North Carolina legislature, say what you will about what they did in the last session, they recognized this when they designated, over $2 million for the North Carolina Child Treatment Program. What is that, and how do you think that money will impact your ability to help these kids?
The General Assembly designated over $2 million to this North Carolina Child Treatment Program, which is dedicated to improving the health and well-being of traumatized children by providing trauma-informed treatment training opportunities to clinicians. So it really is about building the capacity in the community to perform a certain kind of therapy, trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, that's expanding the repertoire of the people who are going to see these kids in mental health facilities. Mm-hmm. As Dr. O'Malley said, a lot of people don't have that extra training. They can't afford to get extra training that's trauma-informed. So the legislature has allocated some funding for this work to be done so that, you know, when you don't make it to Alexander Youth Network, instead are in a rural county and that doesn't have those kinds of services, hopefully you're increasing the chances that somebody within that mental health center can provide the kind of treatment that you need.
And the North Carolina Division of Social Services was also, I understand, awarded a grant for something called Project Broadcast, which is designed to disseminate trauma-informed practices to children within the North Carolina Child Welfare System. Expand on that.
That is a pilot project that is trying to coordinate system-level changes across the system of care in 9 counties. Mecklenburg is not included in that, but it's Buncombe, Craven, Cumberland, Hoke, Pender, Pitt, Scotland, Union, and Wilson counties. And what they are working to do is develop trauma-informed child welfare workplaces. So the caseworkers that are going out on these calls have deepened knowledge about the experiences that these children may have and what are appropriate interventions, and is also developing a plan to incorporate these practices not just within the child welfare system but within other agencies.
When kids come to you and your organization, the Council for Children's Rights, and people don't know, the parents may not know what's wrong with them and why they're exhibiting bad behaviors that are getting them into trouble, enough trouble to get to you. If you recognize mental health issues, do you automatically make sure that these children get that help? Do the parents have to give permission for them to get that help? Do the children have to agree to get that help? How does it work? I only have a minute left.
Well, the parents actually have a lot of control about that. We do try to counsel the children about what we think would be best for them, and that would include what sort of counseling or mental health help they might need. Ultimately, the child can tell us, do or don't talk to my parents about this. Mm-hmm. Most of the time we're able to do that, and we can sit and talk with the parents. Doesn't mean it's going to happen. Just means we can give the advice. We have no authority to sort of make them go or send them out there to do it.
But this trauma-informed therapy that now seems to be spreading beyond Alexander Youth Network to other parts of the state, thanks to this money from the legislature, is a bright spot. Yes?
Absolutely. Yes. The more we can understand the underlying issues, the better we can do at treating them.
Kelly Shearer is the Chief Program Officer. Dr. Dawn O'Malley is the Clinical Director of the Alexander Youth Network. Susan Campbell. Dr. Susan Campbell is Executive Director. Robert McCarter is Managing Attorney for the Council for Children's Rights. Thank you all for the hour.